ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
A confession. A memory. A lie. What if all three could be wrong? Forensic is a new series from All in the Mind, unpacking the hidden psychology of crime solving. Why innocent people confess? How memories can be rewritten? The science behind true crime. All in the Mind, Forensic. Search for All in the Mind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
When novel or disruptive technologies land, so think broadband internet or artificial intelligence, even driverless cars, regional and rural communities are often left behind the big smoke. But can Australia's small towns and rural communities get ahead of the game? And how do you turn adversity into opportunity? Let's go meet some big thinkers here on Big Ideas. I'm Natasha Mitchell. And today the show comes from Lithgow in the central tablelands of New South Wales. Now, the challenges for rural and regional Australia are real. Industries shift or shut down. Drought and other natural disasters are taking a huge toll. Young people leave for opportunities in the city. Today's panel knows all this too well, but also sees interesting opportunities ahead. They're coming to you from the 2026 SEGRA, or Sustainable Economic Growth for Regional Australia Foundation's annual conference. That's the SEGRA National Regional and Economic Development Summit. Now, you're going to meet Jackie Shermer, who has spent more than a decade asking people across regional Australia how you're doing. As founder of the important Regional Wellbeing Survey, she's the Director of Environmental Governance at the University of Canberra. Dr. Jess Jennings is a regional and rural consultant and a former mayor of the Bathurst Regional Council. Bjorn Jarvis heads the Workforce Futures Program at Jobs and Skills Australia. And chairing this one is Ashley Bland, Chair of the SEGRA Foundation and Associate Partner and Business Development Manager for Green Homes International.
Perhaps we should start the conversation with you, Jackie, by asking, how are regional communities doing now?
Look, one of the things we see in the Regional Wellbeing Survey is a real diversity of experiences of regional Australia. So we hear from 15,000 people every year. We ask them how things are going in their community, what's going well, what's not going so well. One of the really common themes is people say they love their community. Even when there's big challenges going on, they say they love living rurally, they love the sense of community, they talk about community events, quality of life, short commute times for some, not for all, being real benefits. But increasingly, we're also seeing people saying the challenges they're experiencing are that there's more of those extreme weather events than there used to be. They're saying it's really challenging when you're getting not one flood, but three floods in a row. And then you've got the drought and then the fire and then the heat wave and then everything else. But they're still saying, hey, we're actually really good at getting through that. So one of the big things that I've been hearing, I've been doing workshops around the country lately, and we've been going and talking to people about resilience, and almost every workshop people say, well, people from the city stop telling people in the country that they need to be more resilient. We're really, really resilient. We're actually so resilient we're getting through those events, even though we don't feel we're getting much support to remove the barriers and the challenges to being resilient. And that brings me to the challenges. The big challenges people are talking to us about are the ones of getting childcare, of having reception in areas where 3G is shut down and the promised amazing reception didn't emerge that they thought they should be getting. It's those long-term issues. When you can't get a tradie for 2 years, it's pretty hard to be resilient to the next fire if you haven't been able to rebuild your infrastructure from the last flood. They're the things that are really challenging people, and that's where there's a growing sense of concern that the sort of compact between the city and rural areas isn't being held up by the city side. I think more and more rural communities are saying we're feeling we're providing a lot to the cities, but we're not getting as much back because we're being asked to do a lot, but we're not getting those health services, that infrastructure, those things in return. We're being told we're not big enough or doing enough to get those things, and that's a real concern.
Well, as we sit here today, we've been blocked off from the largest city in New South Wales by the failure of a road that was built by convicts 196 years ago. But that's not the only thing people are talking to you about. I mean, childcare doesn't necessarily require a road.
Yeah, so are we seeing physical or social infrastructure? I think services is quite big. So what people say is, okay, childcare services, health services, and it's the intersection of services and infrastructure. So, for example, telehealth, absolutely fantastic if you can get really good internet connectivity. You know, it can actually really help. But when you don't have the internet connectivity, or when that telehealth appointment means you've got to go and follow up with a blood test and you need to be able to get on a road or a train or a bus and get something, that's when that intersection of infrastructure and services is letting us down. So we've sort of got fantastic things that could be great, but we're not quite getting it all coordinated enough for the system to work really well.
And Jess, as your experience in local government, I guess the layer of government closest to the people, is that what you were hearing in your communities too?
Absolutely. You know, my lived experience in Bathurst during that last drought, pretty interesting experience when you consider that in 2016, the Ben Chifley Dam, which is our main water supply, was overflowing. And again in 2020, it was overflowing. But in between, we were having conversations at the very end of the drought that really had that drought lasted another 3 months, to my mind. Our senior directors were telling us what their plan was to shut the town down. What do you do when you run out of water? Who do you turn it off to first? And the critical point at which they got to in their sort of modelling of it was that when you turn the water off to schools, parents can't go to work, and the whole system really starts to collapse pretty rapidly. And that, I mean, that was an extraordinary time, and that was only in that 4-year window. I just sort of do wonder quite often, every now and again, what if that drought had gone for another year? Where would we have ended up? And so where are we headed in the future for droughts that are predicted to be longer, more severe? So that's certainly one of the lived experiences. The other one, a life-changing event, essentially from a career perspective, was the advent of satellite internet. So I think we got it at our house in 2020. We lived 10 kilometres out of town. It literally took 7 hours to send a one-word email prior to that, because I tested it. There was a copper line and we were at the very, very end of it. It essentially did not work at all. But when effectively Starlink internet came into being, both my wife and I could work from home, did commonly work from home, and we could then do that and have our kids access the internet all at once, and it actually was a total and utter game changer. And I get that that hasn't sort of come to pass in terms of full adoption yet, but it really is a fundamental part of a greater connectivity that I think really is the, in my mind, the theme of where regional Australia, you know, needs to be able to do better and get better results.
So that, again, is an infrastructure that's not necessarily obvious, like a bridge or a road or a mine or something like that. But it feels like we're often told that, you know, that's going to be the saviour of our regions, these massive infrastructure projects that come out and about. But what you're saying is it's more finesse than that. There's different types of infrastructure required at different communities, and it's not really a one-size-fits-all. Is that right?
I think that's exactly right. And communities, regional communities, are in this vexed situation where, I mean, a pretty chilling statistic to my mind as a citizen of regional Australia is that virtually half of all Australia's economic output comes from Sydney and Melbourne alone. So really it's about sort of, from all capital cities combined, it's about 75% of Australia's. So that means across a huge land mass, the rest of us in that regional area are spanned out over what is essentially an economic condition of market failure that is very commonly typified by, for example, lack of population density. So many things are not easily available to a regional area, because if you want to bring that workforce or you want something to turn on, there isn't the housing, there isn't the sewer, there isn't the services, there isn't the amenities. in my mind, what do you do to try and overcome that? What can you do to get into the trends that are emerging? Well, one, you have to accept change and also embrace change and want to embrace change and get the most out of the things that are emerging. And I guess in my period as a counsellor, I saw opportunities just from the advent of the internet and globalisation was this, the idea of sister cities and connecting markets overseas. And I set up two sister cities, essentially one in China and one in the United Kingdom. That was okay, but they're not often tangibly great beneficial, you know, results. But the other things I pursued, particularly when I was mayor, was to look into the reality of what would emerging technologies such as autonomous vehicles do for regional people? What would electric flight also do for people? You know, the advent of drones and drone technology is remarkable. And the other one I happened to pick up on and go and visit in Las Vegas was tunnelling technology, and that's particularly pertinent now in terms of the current circumstances with the Great Western Highway. But I'm talking about a tunnel that goes from essentially the central west of Penrith, not just 11 kilometres.
So, Ash, if I can build on, and I feel like being called Bjorn when we've got a panel that's Jackie, Jess, at least my last name's Jarvis, kind of building on that theme that's come through from both my co-panellists around connection and connectivity, but also opportunities and challenges. That's a big thing that we're seeing with a piece of work that we're doing in Jobs and Skills Australia. So in addition to having lived and breathed regional Australia, I'm myself from regional Australia. Most of the team that I have that work in our regional team are dotted across the country in regional centres. We've identified that now is a time for a really important conversation around the jobs and skills system. And a lot of it is anchored very much around fostering connection. And connection is a really interesting thing through the consultation. So we released the first phase of the Jobs and Skills Roadmap last July. The next phase of it will be released in a couple of months. It triggered a really interesting conversation, and the number of times that connection came up as a real strength for regional Australia and a real challenge for regional Australia. And so we touched on a few things there when we're talking about the connection of people being a real strength. So in regional Australia, you can be in a community where you do know people, whereas increasingly we're seeing in the major cities people not even knowing, you know, their next door neighbour, let alone the people that they're connected across their network. But seeing the challenges around connection in regional Australia around lining up people and jobs. So people that want to work, employers that are looking for workers. The connectivity of systems and that being a particular pinch point when we're talking about some of the thin markets in regional Australia. Touch on services and that being a critical part of connection, but also information around jobs and awareness and a very different discussion with people that are going through the education and training system in regional Australia compared to the major cities and thinking about the jobs that they may want to do. Now, in terms of the opportunities and challenges that keep coming through loud and clear when we're talking about regional Australia, we've already touched on a couple. So in terms of some of these connected pressures that we're seeing, a bunch of them aren't in the jobs and skills system, but they're things that we've already touched on in the panel. Housing, transport and childcare come through. Regardless of which community we're having a conversation around the jobs and skills system, they always come through in the top three and usually quickly followed by other forms of infrastructure, particularly, as Jess has just touched on, connection to the digital infrastructure. A weakening skills pipeline around young people, and so we're seeing through the data, and apologies for being the data junkie on the panel. I've got a full page of numbers here. Never go anywhere without a good set of numbers. Youth tertiary participation rates are at a decade low. Now, it's not something that is unique to regional Australia, but it is markedly below what we're seeing in the major cities. We're also seeing persistent hiring pressures, but there's a couple of stats that really help to highlight that persistent challenge. And so something that Jobs and Skills Australia does is looks at occupations that are in shortage. Are they in national shortage? Are they in regional shortage and only in regional shortage? And that indicator is probably the most useful one to highlight here today. So if we look at the last 3 years that we've been producing these measures, the number of occupations that are in shortage but only in regional shortage has gone up from 56 occupations to 69 occupations to 119 occupations. And digging into that, we can see that occupations that are in shortage will often emerge in shortage and be identified in shortage in regional Australia before they're seen nationally, and will still be in regional shortage when they're no longer in regional shortage in the major cities. But building on, so a big focus with our roadmap is making sure that we've got a strong focus around the opportunities, and the opportunities have already been touched on here as well. So there are opportunities for jobs. So it's not a discussion around a roadmap for how do you create more jobs. It's really around how do we get the system to work in a better way in order to be able to get people into these jobs. So regional Australia, more than the major cities, doesn't have an issue with the availability of work. In fact, there's more work than people can poke a stick at. It's finding people, and in particular, people with the right skills and the right skill pipeline. Now, part of that's grow your own, part of that's attraction. Part of that is also, and particularly looking at people in my own team at Jobs and Skills Australia, who leave, study, work in the capital cities, and then what is the return pool in order to bring them back into the community. So some real opportunities there for regional Australia to really be the best version of itself.
I mean, it feels like what you've discussed there is the fitness of the training and education system to be adapting to whatever changes are going on in the region.
And one of the interesting things that comes through every regional conversation that we have with every regional community is the amount of really innovative new growth opportunities in regions. And so regional communities, more so than the major cities, often have really entrepreneurial people who are often willing to try things and almost become a bit of a microcosm for something that could be explored at the broader level. So we are seeing a range of, so the net zero transition, we're seeing a whole range of really innovative technology being thought about, developed and pioneered. So some of that discussion around the amount of highly skilled knowledge workers who are now living somewhere in regional Australia, connected to the major cities, but calling regional Australia at home. But an increasingly hybrid workforce will also enable a whole range of opportunities that haven't existed in the past. So the ability for a whole range of innovative technologies, innovative businesses, but also a range of jobs that have never previously had a footprint in regional Australia, and working from home, that is an enormous opportunity. And as we've seen, the migration from the major cities to regional Australia is still higher. And if you look at every well-being related indicator, or the recent survey that the Regional Australia Institute asked people about the likelihood that they would consider moving to regional Australia, when you look at young workers, skilled young workers, particularly people that have got professional jobs or highly skilled qualifications, there is a real appetite for them to move to regional Australia to pursue some of these opportunities.
Regional consultant Dr. Jess Jennings there with Jackie Shermer from the University of Canberra, founder of the Regional Wellbeing Survey, and Bjorn Jarvis from Jobs and Skills Australia. The discussion host is Ashley Bland, chair of the Sustainable Economic Growth for Regional Australia Foundation, or SEGRA, exploring opportunities today that are on the horizon for regional Australia. On ABC Radio National's live event show, Big Ideas. I'm Natasha Mitchell, and I'm joining you at the 2026 SEGRA National Regional and Economic Development Summit today, held in Lithgow, New South Wales. Back to Jackie.
We see big differences in regional Australia, and we see people wanting to come to regional Australia. But when we ask regional Australians, if you could, would you shift to another community? The ones who are living in communities where they can't access basic health services, where they have difficulty getting childcare, we're seeing rates of up to 50% of people saying, I would shift somewhere else if I could. And we are seeing that mobility as people find they want to work from home, but they can't get the childcare. So it's that enabling environment that I think we've got the enthusiasm, we've got the entrepreneurship, we've got all the ideas, but we're finding that the enabling environment isn't there. And that is that real challenge. If we can overcome some of that, I think the future is, you know, it's limitless for regional Australia. But if we keep on butting up against these issues of this infrastructure service nexus that's challenging people, I think there's a real threat to these opportunities actually emerging and becoming what they could be.
There's no shortage of opportunities in regional Australia, as you say, but how do you break that problem? You just said if we can overcome it. What are your thoughts? How do we overcome it?
Yeah, I've been struggling with this one, and I guess I'm seeing people talking to me about their frustrations, so, and talking to us through our surveys, and they're saying things like, okay, I know what I want to do to expand my business, but I'm seeing there's a lot of regulatory burden in the way. I'm finding there's just a lot of barriers. So anything we can do to reduce regulatory burden, and that cuts across business, but also the community sector. So when we ask people, why are we seeing a decline in volunteers in regional Australia? And this is a big issue at the moment. People talk about difficulty getting insurance for events, difficulty getting approvals for the different things they need to do as an organisation. We need to make it easier in small areas to get ahead and do things. That's one of the biggest things people are telling us.
I'll just add, I guess, that, I mean, it's very much been the case characterised for Bathurst, which is a relatively large regional town, around 40,000. Our population increase over the 10, 12 years I was in council, the majority of it came from satellite towns around us. You know, people moving from Oberon, you know, Portland, smaller places, less so recently from Lithgow, for example. But that's generally been the trend, that, and that's obviously chasing health services, education as critical infrastructure that we all need. But I would emphasise, I think one huge opportunity is essentially those professional services. You've highlighted it and mentioned it by Productivity Commissioners, work from home. That, to me, has an opportunity to create more of that critical mass in regional areas that then brings all those services, more infrastructure-oriented services with them that you need, you know, food, fibre, you know, connection to schools, etc. The opportunity is enormous, but it has to be competitive with living in the city. It has to have that sort of seamlessness. When I moved to Bathurst in around about 2010, all I needed really to do my job at that time was a mobile phone and a laptop. And most of it was done by mobile phone and a lot of emailing and a hell of a lot of teleconferences. And there was a period there that probably a few of your people in the room recognise that teleconferencing was a really major productivity boost in the way you could get work done, and a lot could happen that way. And we've obviously moved into, say, you know, video conferencing now, etc. But to make it comparable and to make the regions as competitive, I think you have to start looking into those other ways of being connected, whether it's virtually connected, physically connected, and sort of at the ground level, emotionally connected. And for me, one of the reasons I went to San Francisco to go for a ride in a driverless taxi was because of the concept that if I had access to a genuinely driverless autonomous vehicle, and all I had to do in the morning was get up, get in the vehicle, start working, make phone calls, have a sleep, get myself ready for a meeting at 11 o'clock in Sydney, and then get back in the vehicle and keep working and come back, it kind of made no difference to whether I was in 10 kilometres south of Bathurst or in Balmain, where I used to live when I fled from the city. So that opportunity, I think, is extraordinary, and I think regional areas need to keep an eye on that and see how they can, you know, induce what it might look like, I don't know, pilots in the regional areas of autonomous vehicles, etc. But they are coming. There's Waymo, that I managed to get access to a Waymo taxi and managed to talk to some management and got into the waiting list to go for a ride. And I was a bit nervous, got to say. I did my due diligence. We had hire a car. We spotted a few in San Francisco driving around and followed them for a good half hour to an hour, going, has any of them crashed? Are they doing anything stupid? Is it what is this situation? And then I followed one of them, actually, and it was quite a remarkable moment. And we're driving down. This is, San Francisco is a pretty busy place, right? And steep, and trams, and, you know, all sorts of stuff going on. Like, you know, the centre of Newtown in Sydney, but on 45-degree angle. And we're following this Waymo taxi, and then all of a sudden it took quite a quick left-hand turn where there was no street, but there was a driveway. It was going back to base. And so we pulled over quickly. I was with my son at the time and went and had a look in there, and there was like 300 Waymo taxis, all empty, coming and going as they were being called up to do their stuff. Now, that was kind of mind-blowing, I've got to say. And the taxi ride itself by after about 10 minutes, so we started at the top of San Francisco, up at the back near the park, took a ride down through the city to Chinatown, thinking that would be nice and busy and chaotic sort of conditions to give it a good test, had lunch and then got a taxi ride back home. After about 10, it was about a 25-minute ride each way. After about the 10, 15-minute mark, we felt completely and utterly relaxed and comfortable about it. And that said, it went through three orange lights, which I would have gone through too, right? But it wasn't fast, it wasn't aggressive, and it was not slow. It was not overly cautious. It was purpose-driven. And Waymo is now delivering over 400,000 rides of driverless rides a week. A week. And Tesla's got its approach, and Zoox is another company which has got its approach. So Tesla's moving to the venue of, or the area of, the next generation of cars will not have a steering wheel or pedals. Zoox started that way. It doesn't have a front or back. There's no steering wheel at front, no steering wheel at the back. It's a people mover. It's designed to have like 6 to 8 people. I just think there's a lot happening there.
You know, for elderly people, as they lose their licenses, they can still go shopping. For people with disability, they would have access and all that. So how do we, I mean, that's great for you going to work, but how do we make sure that people who don't have the financial wares also take advantage of this technology?
The first point I'd make about the autonomous stuff is that on average, something like 3 people are killed every year between Lithgow and Bathurst alone. Head-on collisions. There was one, 2023, I think it was, 5 people were killed straight up. Now, if one thing that autonomous vehicles can do is probably avoid head-ons pretty well. I mean, it's going to come down to cost, essentially. I mean, that whole market failure scenario that I talked about before. But I think if these technologies do come into play, I mean, electric vehicles are also reduced marginal cost to actually operate, so they're becoming more affordable over time. And autonomous vehicles, electric vehicles, it's all been hypothesized as kind of that's where we're headed. It takes longer and it takes years. I mean, who knows when it's going to be a viable concern, but I do believe that governments in Australia are starting to talk about pilots for autonomous vehicles and engage. But I know for a fact, for example, that Waymo is not interested in a market that doesn't have the ability to, support taxi riding, on a large scale. So it's not really of interest to them to come to regional Australia. But how can regional Australia make it worthwhile? Because I reckon as regional drivers, we probably do more actual kilometres on average, the most people in the city, that we probably spend the same amount of time in the car. Takes me 20 minutes to get to work if I go into town to, do business, then same as someone in Sydney spends 20 minutes, half an hour in the car, but they've only gone 3 kilometres, whereas I've gone 30 kilometres or something.
Bjorn, okay, so Jess has hopped into the car for his Sydney meetings, fallen asleep because he's drunk too much of the local brewery's beer or whatever, but he's possibly left a child in childcare. I'm really interested in the implications you guys have looked at around AI and the distribution of skills. We heard a great line here yesterday from Professor Beer saying AI has never given anyone a hug. And I suspect that we don't, the same applies in things like childcare. How do we, are these technologies likely to make more people available to the human sort of hands-on kind of industries so that Jess has got more likelihood of having somebody at childcare or is that not the case?
Yeah, that's a great series of questions, and we could pretty much talk for the entire day talking about what came out of the JSA generative AI study that we released last year. The short answer is yes. So when we drill into the applications of AI in jobs and the work that people do in those jobs, AI is more likely generally to augment rather than automate jobs, but also likely to position us long-term to be doubling down on the things that are human-centric and where people really matter. Now, stepping back, we are also, like with the discussions around automated cars and a whole range of these new and emerging technologies, really at the early stage. So AI as a technology, there's a whole range of different AIs. There's AI that's been around for decades and we've just never really described it as AI. when we're generally talking about AI at the moment, we're talking about generative AI, and we're talking about things like Copilot, ChatGPT, all those different applications, which are very much in our mind at the moment because they're things that all of us can actually interact with, and we can do it on our phone, and you know that's quite a democratising technology that we haven't actually seen with other things in the past. But really, it only became available to all of us to be able to access about 3.5 years ago, late 2022, and people are still trying to work out exactly what it's likely to look like. So there's a couple of things I think that are really important for us to reflect on in terms of regional Australia. Part of it is going a bit to Jess's point, the risks around the digital divide. So whenever we talk about AI, it's with an eye to the opportunities and the challenges. So being in regional Australia, you are currently more likely to be in a job where there's a lower exposure to augmentation and automation in what you're doing and how you're doing it from AI. Now, the flip side of that is you're more likely to be in a job where you're not going to get exposed to the exciting opportunity to be playing with the technology, learning some and developing skills with this new technology and positioning yourself, particularly if you're just entering the labour market, for the 30, 40, 50 years ahead of you in the labour market. But we're early enough in the piece that what we highlighted in our study was we're early enough that we're not seeing anything yet in terms of impacts, and we can make intentional decisions now as individuals, as employers, as industries, as governments, as universities and tertiary education providers across the VET system as well, to position us to maximise opportunities and to minimise the challenges. But a really important part of what we looked at was every single occupation that we have at the moment, so every single job in the Australian labour market can be using this technology. So it's not just a case of, oh, this is something for the data entry people, and the data entry people disproportionately live in the major cities, or people that are working in telemarketing or administrative roles. Like, there's real applications across the board. If you're working in agribusiness, the potential to be able to use generative AI for a whole bunch of complex things that you could never do or never do yourself without having to look at kind of commissioning, you know, a really expensive consultancy. Like, there's applications across, like we saw a great example of someone in regional WA just outside of Perth who was using generative AI to help work on a 1975 Volvo. He's like, this manual is starting to fall apart and it's such an old thing, but I owe this guy a favour, so I'm working on his car, and ran that through AI, and it was able to actually help him do it and do it efficiently while recognising that he had two vacancies in his business that he hadn't been able to fill. So if we're talking about the opportunities here, they're real, there's enormous productivity opportunities, but it's something that all of us need to be engaged with. Now, another thing that we looked at was also looking at what employers are looking for, going to your questions around the human skills and AI never giving people a hug. The interesting thing is across all the job advertisements across the Australian labour market, the last few years we've seen an increasing share of job ads talking about human-centric skills. And it's not just a case of these are jobs that are not AI related. Even in the ones that are talking about AI, they're shouting out the importance of critical thinking, being able to work with people, being able to communicate. So even in the AI related applications in the labour market, the human and what makes us valuable as individuals within our communities, within businesses and within the economy is continuing to shine through in everything.
And so to what extent does your framework look at ways to foster those? If it's true that in the future that will be more important, then is our VET and skills and tertiary, prime, you know, is our education sector set for delivering those skills now?
So about half the recommendations that we had in the study were specifically around skills. And I think the short answer is it's not there yet, but the green shoots are very promising. And so across the VET system, there's a laser focus on how do we actually build this into training packages and make sure that this is actually built into the range of offerings that we have. The same with higher education. Higher education's a little bit further ahead than VET, but there's also a lot more activity and in particular work by the Australian government working with the Future Skills Organisation, so one of the 10 Jobs and Skills Councils, in order to accelerate the work that's happening around embedding AI into VET. That's not just in terms of the course offerings, but also the vocational education and training workforce and the higher education training workforce and them being critical in being able to fast track that. But everyone's aligned, everyone's focused, and we're early enough that we should be able to pull this off.
Just make one point. I could not imagine anything worse than being hugged by AI, to be honest. I mean, my use of ChatGPT is fine, but I'm just not looking forward to some sort of genuinely emotional connection.
Turning the challenges of living in regional Australia into opportunities. A how-to discussion from the 2026 SEGRA National Regional and Economic Development Summit. I'm Natasha Mitchell. And if you think your friends and colleagues could benefit from this conversation, share the show. Look for ABC Radio National's Big Ideas on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. You're hearing today from regional consultant Dr. Jess Jennings, Jackie Shermer from the University of Canberra, Bjorn Jarvis from Jobs and Skills Australia, and the moderator is Ashley Bland, who is chair of the SEGRA Foundation. Next, how is social media influencing regional Australia and its prospects?
A follow-up question that maybe for Jackie, I'm not sure, is to what extent has wellness been affected and impacted by the advent of social media and particularly younger audiences given the change of laws in Australia?
Yeah, it's a really good question and it's a really vexed one because we talk a lot about the harms of social media, particularly for young people, but we often don't talk about the benefits social media has had, particularly for kids in rural areas who are able to connect to communities of people that they might not otherwise have been able to. So I think the jury's out on the benefits versus costs of the ban. I think there are kids, particularly kids who are experiencing challenges, who've lost access to the communities that they need to have access to feel like there's somewhere they belong. But at the same time, I think hopefully it's helping reorient some kids to real connection in their everyday world. But I think the question should be, how can we make social media a more beneficial place rather than just should we ban it or not? We need to actually think intentionally about how do we build really good communities that build people up through social media. And I think we're not spending enough time doing that. But I look at things like volunteering in rural Australia. It runs on, you know, WhatsApp, on Facebook groups, on all those sorts of things. Those things have actually made huge differences in helping people connect and actually get things done. But we're still struggling with how to actually transition from the old way we've done things to the new ways we're doing things. We're struggling to transition from the idea of people being formal volunteers in organisations to sort of just putting out a call on your community Facebook group and getting people to turn up to something. We've got to figure out how to actually harness it and use it to promote wellbeing for everybody.
That's a really good point because I'm sitting here listening to you talk about AI and how that could be implemented and really just seeing a big question mark in terms of the mechanism of how that becomes a tool for regional Australia. And similarly, if I look back at what you're saying, Jackie, we've effectively, you know, embraced social media without any deliberacy around how it would impact our communities or how we would use it. We just kind of fumbled our way through it. You know, there's an element in here about how we decide as communities and how we embrace these technology, isn't there? And how we, like, how do we not muck this up too, I guess is my question. You know, what are the mechanisms we need to embed in decision-making around regional communities so that it's not just us and them, black and white, I'm in my social media echo chamber. You know, we are living in a more and more contested environment, potentially a post-truth environment where we can't even agree on common things. How do we make sure we don't end up with AI in the same situation we've done with social media, where we're now trying to stop teenage kids, you know, being in a poor state?
Look, very, very good question and very well said. I think the short answer to that is what's captured in the three pillars of the National AI Plan. And so Australia is in a good position, and when the AI Plan was released at the end of last year, kind of closing out 2025 and starting 2026 in a reasonable position where we're identifying the real economic growth opportunities, and it's been really interesting seeing a range of AI-related discussions then translate into discussions around data centres and to what extent Australia does want to pursue a whole range of interesting growth opportunities, but also talking about needing to spread the benefits, and so that being a really important pillar where it's making sure that people aren't left behind, you don't have the digital divide, and everyone is being taken on the journey, and then a third pillar around safe and responsible. And so certainly, from my perspective, I feel like that's a balanced, holistic approach. Australia hasn't just gone all in on this is a really exciting opportunity and just kind of letting it run, but also hasn't just defaulted to regulation and trying to strangle it. So I think that is something that didn't exist when we embarked on the journey around social media. It's not something that we did when the internet was first being rolled out, you know, a generation ago. So that may not necessarily solve all of those questions, but I feel like we're engaging in the right discussions in the right way.
I mean, I think the end game is just appropriate use for so many of these technologies, whether it be e-bikes at the moment raging in, you know, cities and some of the regional areas, social media in particular. How do you use such a brilliant tool but not let it damage society at the same time and individuals? And you know, I mean, clearly cars did not have seatbelts in them when they first hit the roads. They were regulated. They were put into, you know, various sort of forms of regulation. And I think we're just going to feel our way through these things. And unfortunately, you know, generally the approach, as is naturally the case, when disasters occur, we then look back and go, well, let's how do we avoid that in the future, rather than being overly proactive. One of the things that's freaked me out a bit recently, not too long ago, was reading David Gillespie's Teen Brain about screen addiction for teenagers. Absolutely horrifying. Absolutely horrifying for anyone who's got a parent, who's a parent who's had a kid who's grown up with the internet and the screen. And there we are mainlining our kids onto screens as soon as iPhones and iPads and the rest actually went into schools, you know, actually part of education policy. So, yeah, appropriate use, getting to that point, it's definitely going to take some time, and regulation's clearly part of the picture.
Yeah, and what I'd add to that is for rural Australia, having a sense of control and a say over how this works for rural Australia as well as for urban Australia. I guess when I think about things like renewable energy, I'm sorry to bring up renewable energy in the debate about it, but when we go and talk to rural communities about why is there concern about big renewable energy projects, it's not that there's opposition to the idea of renewable energy. It's a sense of having things done to your rural community, not with your rural community, and not being able to direct and guide and say, here's what we actually want to do to guide our destiny. So with all of these, how do we ensure rural Australia has a say and has leadership and has control over how this works for the benefit of rural Australia, instead of feeling like, hey, this has all been sort of set up and sort of effectively we've been forced to live with it as it comes out to us. We're not getting a say in how to make it work well. We need to think more about how we can build that voice of regional, rural and remote communities so that they get to guide what happens in their communities and feel more sense of control over it.
Very nice, but with respect, as Jess said, if 50% or, you know, if all that GDP is in the cities, then why should they care?
Because change is going to happen one way or the other. I mean, if you do absolutely nothing, circumstances are going to change around you. And there's no doubt, I think nobody would even question that the world is changing, has always been changing. And unless you get to a, you know, come to grips with that and have some sort of sense of acceptance of that, I think that's the first step towards saying, well, how do we get the most out of this change? How do we be part of it rather than having it done to us? And how do we get the most actual benefits from it, whether it be benefit sharing from a wind farm or whether it be, you know, spotting an opportunity in an overseas market that you can access?
Yeah, but I think we also need to increase recognition of what rural Australia is doing to support that 75% of the urban economy. You know, that's, we talk about, oh, it's only 25%, it's only this, it's only that, but what's happening in that 25% is enabling what is happening in the cities. And I kind of feel like we're a little bit out of whack in terms of the benefit and cost sharing in that relationship at the moment. And we need to have stronger rural voice so that we get more benefit back.
As my uncle would say, who still grows broccoli, we just need to go hungry a bit down there a bit, you know, like, just be a bit hungry for a while. All of you have sort of mentioned regulation and a frustration around red tape. And I think in terms of that productivity commission, finding out where Australia's productivity crisis, the easiest way to find it is actually just to try and do something. It feels like there's a lot of barriers. Have you got any quick ideas around, or it doesn't have to be a quick idea, any ideas, please, around this? Because wherever I go, I hear people frustrated. As soon as you try and do something, somebody will say no. Are we just ridiculously risk-averse in this country? Have we lost our can-do mentality, even in the country, to actually get anything done?
I'm looking at the crickets around the panel. I'm sorry. Okay, look, I guess the one thing that came to mind for me was one-stop shops, because what commonly comes up is people saying it wasn't that I had to get approval that was the issue, it's that I had to get approval from seven different people and each of those seven different people didn't know what the other one was doing or reviewing or approving, and I had to submit the same thing to the seven different people. So one-stop shops, where people in those one-stop shops actually have the authority to make a decision, can make a really big difference. And that doesn't mean reducing the regulation, it just means making the processes work more smoothly.
At the start of the discussion, we talked connection and connectivity. Related to that is also connectors. And so I think an interesting kind of extension of your question there, Ash, is how much of the challenges around regulation, as Jackie was kind of touching on, the experiences that people have around regulation or how services and support connect, highlights the fact that things aren't as connected as they should be. And that earlier question you're asking around what would make a big difference in terms of childcare, housing, transport, what, there's enormous investment, there's enormous focus across a whole range of systems that run in parallel and are trying to achieve similar things, but they're often very focused in their particular lane. And so what we've seen, particularly through the work the JSA has been doing around the Jobs and Skills Roadmap, is how often people highlight that the systems aren't connected. So the systems aren't connected because the systems are all optimised around trying to run the best system rather than the best overall system or the best thing from a community perspective. And it's been interesting how often people point to not the need for more strategies or these kind of mega kind of, you know, meta strategies that kind of combine strategies together, but actually looking and saying, well, what are the connection points that you can build between these? So connections where they are specifically tied together and you're actually looking at whether it's hubs and some of those kind of mechanisms or the need for more connectors in the system who can actually see where things are fragmented and where they need to be joined up, particularly when you're talking about a place-based conversation and what people are actually seeing on the ground. And that's something that I think regional Australia is uniquely positioned to be able to do. Like, you don't see people who are as good at doing that connector role in the major cities as what you see, you know, around the room here today or anywhere across regional Australia. And the interesting conversation that we've had through the you know, extensive rounds of consultation that we've had around the roadmap is how often people will say, well, this needs to be done in every community because so-and-so was able to basically join that, and that, and tell all of those systems. Now, they just need to get on and sort their stuff together. We've identified those kind of connection points. So our sense is if we can make inroads into building more connection between the systems, that will also help with regulation, because you'll then see some of these things that are working at odds, slowing things down, but also getting a better aggregate view of what the total cumulative load of regulation is across the system.
Yeah, so the fact that Marge knows what everybody's doing on the main street and who turns up to footy ends up being actually really good for productivity. That's great. Jess?
Just to add a little bit, I think it's also easy to get into a defeatist narrative that we're being you know, choked by regulation and that's the end of the story and nothing's ever going to be built anymore or things aren't going to progress, whether it be blocking a housing supply issue crisis across Australia, you know, or major infrastructure projects. And I think just on a hypothetical question, could the Sydney Harbour Bridge be built today? Well, the answer is yes. There's a tunnel being built right now and the tunnel boring machines are under the harbour right now. It's a massive, massive thing. Slightly further west, again, metropolitan oriented, is the Western Sydney Airport. You know, another massive... I mean, and to me, these are all growing pain things for a country with relatively small population. As our population continues and the whole world's population is increasing in growth, communities, societies, countries go through growing pains, and these are some of the feelings that we you know have as this sort of dissatisfaction, or you don't see it happen immediately, but it might happen in your lifetime, you know, over decades.
It is interesting. I also showed a photo of Willerawang Power Station being built in the 1950s, and you're right to point that out, Jess. We go through these transitions, we survive them, and we do try and make the best of them. So the question around the percentages or statistics around migrants in regional Australia and the impact.
So a great question. On jobsandskills.gov.au, we have a whole range of regional migration and also kind of migrant-related profiles that can very much answer that question.
At a quick point, I know that from the taxi driver in Bathurst that 5 years ago there were 80 Nepalese in Bathurst and now there's 800, and they absolutely underpin the aged care sector in that town. Well, what I will do then, I would really like to hear you guys round up in what it is that you love about regional Australia. You clearly are embedded and part of that. Can you just tell us what it is that you love about being in regional Australia?
Look, I think having been someone who actually grew up in the inner west in Sydney, in a very urban area, went to Glebe High School, grew up in Forest Lodge, to me, part of it is the simple fact that it's not the inner west and it's not, you know, sitting in the middle of 5 million people. I really love the space, the natural environment, and the localised feel of your average community.
Yeah, look, I'm struggling to pick what I love most. So for me, I've lived both in rural Australia and in cities. I currently live in Canberra. But for me, it's that sense of space and opportunity, an opportunity to take up and have a go at anything that you want to. So there's always the opportunity to get involved in 100 different things in a rural community. And there's always that opportunity to do it. You won't get shut out.
As someone who grew up in regional Australia, has moved in and out of regional Australia, I'm also, you know, currently in Canberra, which a bunch of people I know in Sydney would describe as being regional Australia, even though Jobs and Skills Australia doesn't define it as regional Australia. But I guess one of the things that did attract me to Canberra of all the major cities is it's the most like a regional community. People are much more connected, and that is a real asset and a real strength. And I think the discussion earlier on around AI and thinking, like using this as an opportunity to think of us as humans, it's really interesting the conversation that it's triggering across the major cities around community, around connection. And I wouldn't be surprised if there are a whole bunch of people across Australia that community and connection is moving higher and higher on their list.
Well, that can only be a good thing. And certainly I thank you all for connecting with this community today, a community of regional practitioners. Can you please give our panel a warm round of applause? Thank you.
A future for regional Australia. Its challenges, its opportunities, both, as you heard from the annual SEGRA National Regional and Economic Development Summit, with host Ashley Bland, who is chair of the SEGRA Foundation, and an associate partner and business development manager for Green Homes International. You heard from Jackie Shermer, Director of Environmental Governance at the University of Canberra, founder of the Regional Wellbeing Survey. Dr. Jess Jennings, regional and rural consultant and former mayor of Bathurst Regional Council, and Bjorn Jarvis, the head of the Workforce Futures Program at Jobs and Skills Australia. Hey, get in touch. We love hearing from you and your response to what you're hearing on the show. Our email address, bigideas@abc.net.au. Bigideas@abc.net.au. And I'm Natasha Mitchell. Next on the show, how can Plato help us make sense of the present? Coming up.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.